Okay, let's wind up the rubber band and see what happens next. Walt, I can bring my iPad. Take off, if you could, you take over for a minute.
Okay, so Grace, I will hand over to Javed for agenda paper six.
Thank you. So I turn your attention to paper six. This discusses an issue related to service concession arrangement in which the infrastructure is weak and the operator does not have to perform any construction or upgrade services in relation to the infrastructure. The submitter describes an arrangement that has three parties, the operator, the grantor, and the lessor. The lessor may or may not be related to the grantor. The operator enters into an arrangement to provide a public service, and the infrastructure is actually leased from the lessor. The operator is required to make payments in relation to the arrangement with the lessor, and it has an unconditional right to receive cash from the grantor in respect of providing the what I'll call lease-related services. The submitter has asked the committee to clarify whether the arrangement is within the scope of District 12. If it is within the scope, then the submitter wants clarification on whether the operator should recognize any assets or liabilities associated with the arrangement with the lessor, and whether the operator can present any such assets and liabilities on a net basis. So the committee first discussed this issue in November, and with respect to the scope issue, the committee observed that assessing whether the arrangement is within the scope would require careful consideration of all facts and circumstances. This paper analyzes the recognition and recognition and presentation issues, and we have discussed them separately for arrangements where the lessor is related to the grantor and arrangements where they're not related to the grantor. I will ask for your views on these separately, and then at the end I'll ask you overall whether you agree with proposing a tentative agenda decision. So looking at the arrangements where the lessor is related to the grantor, we think that the payments made by the operator to the lessor are in substance payments made by an operator to a grantor in a service concession arrangement. Because the financial asset model is applicable to these payments, we think the grantor is no different than a customer in a revenue arrangement. And consequently, we think that the operator would account for these payments by applying the requirements in IFRS 15 on accounting for consideration payable to a customer. So I will stop there and just ask if you agree with the staff analysis for arrangements where the lessor is related to the grantor.
Comments? Carl?
Thanks. I generally agree with staff's analysis and the agenda decision. However, I have a concern about the lack of reference to IFRS 16 when you address to a liability recognition. I think it's necessary to refer this analogy because I have the fear that under IS 17 could be a different answer. So I think it's important to establish that this rationale was based on the IFRS 16 analogy.
I'll come back to that. I think this, just to wrap up the situation where they are related to the grantor, and then maybe I'll just move on to situations where they're not related, and that's where I think you're...
The non-related.
Yeah. So I'll just come to that in a minute. Any other...
Other comments?
Yeah.
John?
I suppose I have a question in the one where the lessor is related to the grantor. There's an assumption in the paper that you consider them to be the same party, and I know that AG2 of IFRIC 12 does actually say you consider the grantor and another public sector or government parties controlled by that government together. But that's really only for the purposes of paragraph 5A, which is determining whether it's controlled by regulation. In other words, putting them together to effectively assess control. We've put them together to assess that they're effectively their one customer, and therefore you would apply the consideration payable to a customer guidance. And I'm not sure I'd reach the same answer that you would offset the asset and the liability if I have an amount payable to one government entity over here, payable to the lessor government entity here, and receivable here. I mean, I'm not, I don't necessarily disagree with that answer from a conceptual point of view, because it seems to me it's a backwards and forwards cash flow with the same ultimate party. But if you're in contractual rights to receive cash and contractual obligations to pay cash, there are different parties that you go to, you really not have to use the offsetting guidance to get there. I know reference is made to the consideration payable to a customer guidance in IFRS 15, but does that give you a right to offset that doesn't exist in IAS 39?
So I think when looking at IFRS, so again, going back to 82, yes, I agree, to talk about the control criteria, and it does go on to say that they shall be treated, any party shall be treated as related for the purposes of the standard. So we treat them as related, and I think looking at the guidance in IFRS 15 on revenue, it does talk about determining the net considerations first. So if there is a gross up of cash flow before going into the IAS 32 offsetting criteria, I would look at IFRS 15 and net the consideration, and then look at how the net consideration is accounted for. So I'm not necessarily sure I would even get into IAS 32 offsetting criteria in that case.
I agree with how the net consideration is accounted for in terms of recognition of revenue, but what about if I had an amount that's payable to a downstream customer and I had an amount receivable from my direct customer? Are they offsettable from an asset and liability point of view? Just a question.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah, along with similar lines, but a little bit different, I had a question where I thought the last meeting we were talking in the fact patterns about where the grantor and the lessor were under common control. And here we're using related parties, and there could, I'm not sure there are many cases, but there could be a difference. But we're saying we're going to apply this this way if they're related parties, even if they're not under common control.
The fact pattern did talk about common control, so we can restrict the scope of the agenda decision to common control. The intention was to keep it to the submission.
Okay, because I don't remember seeing that in the agenda decision.
But we can clarify
that. Yeah, we'll fix that.
Okay. Yeah, so let's change
Point
the agenda decision
yeah,
to common control.
That and make sure that we clarify that they are under common control.
And that might, by the way, help. John, I don't know if that might help your point. Maybe not totally, but slightly.
Yeah. I think even if parties are under common control, you don't get a right to offset the financial asset and the financial liability. So.
Yeah.
Tony?
It was a similar thing. I guess I wondered, the question we were originally asked is about, in this situation, is whether or not the operator should recognise assets and liabilities. And we're kind of not answering the question by pushing off to the guidance in IFRS 15. Now, I might look at the guidance in IFRS 15 that I recognise was not designed to address this situation, but it does say you recognise payments to a customer at the later of when you recognise the revenue and when you make the payment. And so I might use that to say, well, actually, if I haven't recognised the revenue nor have I made the payment, I don't have to recognise the amount that's payable to the customer. I recognise that's... probably using the words in IFRS 15 for a purpose for which they were not intended. And so I do think there is a question about whether, once I've signed up, I've got an obligation to make a stream of payments over here and the right to receive a stream of payments from here. And applying IAS 32, I'm not sure I would get to offset them if they were different government entities.
Yeah.
And if you're intending to finesse what IFRS 15 says, then I think we should be explicit to say that you should offset, and so we do the whole thing net. But if not, we need to. I think we ought to clarify whether or not assets and liabilities are recognised.
Okay. Our focus now is, correct me if I'm wrong, essentially paragraph 44A. Of the paper. That's the first recommendation where the arrangements of the lessor is related to the operator. And you're going to change that to where the lessor and the operator are under
common control.
Correct. Okay. John?
In relation to the change to where they're under common control. I mean, that's not the terminology that's used in AG2 of Article 12. It's where they're related parties. So it's actually got nothing to do with common control. It's got to do whether the parties that the grantor and the parties that regulate are actually related. So I'm not sure that introducing the notion of common control is consistent with Article 12.
I think we were trying to be consistent with the submission.
Correct.
Other comments? Tony, do you have some wording suggestions that will deal with your problem?
I actually think it's more of a question for the committee, and it's really the question that John raised, which is, do we agree with what I think the staff is proposing here, and you can tell me whether it's right, that in fact you would not gross up the balance sheet for the amount receivable from this side and payable to that side of the government. I don't think that, you know, I could write some words to say yes or no, but I'm not sure that's the thing. I think that's the question for the committee, is do we think ought to be grossed up?
And just to clarify, I think that, Tony, what you and what John is raising the question of is that, given that these are not parties within one consolidated group, in a sense, it's just two separate government agencies, do we think we potentially might be overriding the offsetting requirements?
But even if it was two members of the same group, would you necessarily, so I've got
two separate subsidiaries
of the same bank, cash pooling in a minute.
I agree.
Would I?
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. What you're saying is, if there's any, are we overriding the offsetting requirements?
Are you reading what paragraph 72 of IFRS 15 says about when you recognise consideration payable to a customer at the later of? Are you looking at that to say, fine, I'm not going to gross up? I actually think that's probably a more sensible and more helpful answer in this situation. Mm-hmm. But I think John makes a good point that you might not get there, sensible or not, if you applied IS 32. John, is that?
I don't object to offsetting them, because it seems to me that their cash flows to and from effectively the same party in a service concession arrangement. Mm. But AG2 puts the related parties and the grantor together for a particular purpose, for assessing control of the infrastructure. It doesn't put them together to override the requirements of IAS 39 or any other standard. So I think, I'd be comfortable to expand AG2 into the notion that there's only one counterparty, but I think you would have to do something to get there, because IAS 39 would tell you they're not the same counterparty.
So I think what I'm saying is, I think we're saying the same thing, we don't object to offsetting, but I think we need to decide that offsetting is the right answer.
Bob?
What Tony and John are raising, I think, is another issue that exists within not just the ones where they're related, but it's an issue within the when they're unrelated. And I've had this issue with, I'm struggling to understand, in either case, who the operator is obligated to. If I understand correctly what the logic that we're going down, we're saying that if it's in the scope of IFRIC 12, that the right to use asset belongs with the grantor. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. If the grantor has the right to use asset, then shouldn't they also, in substance, have the lease obligation?
I think that, well,
because I don't know how to separate the two. I don't know how you say one party has the right to use, but the other party has the obligation. If you then say that, okay, in substance, this is not the contractual, but we're saying we're not following the legal rights of the right to use asset. We're saying, yeah, the legal rights belong with the operator, but in substance, it belongs with the grantor. And the grantor then has the lease obligation. Then I think, in my mind logically, the operator has an obligation to the grantor. And that solves my problem that John raises, which is because now I am paying the same party as I have the service concession with.
Does it make sense? Because the conversation naturally and I think appropriately has moved into the next section on where the grantor and the lessor are not related, would it be helpful if Java teed up that and we continue our conversation?
Yeah.
Okay, let's let Charlotte come in, and then we will do that.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of coming from the same place. I think it overlaps with that question. I think the question of whether you've got the principal agent relationship in the non-related question is the sort of same thing, because then you end up in a position where you've got net revenues. I'm not sure who's acting as who they're acting as an agent for, but you end up with net revenues. But in that situation, you're saying you still gross up the balance sheet, while in the situation in the related parties, you're saying they're net, but you don't ever get to gross up. And it just doesn't seem consistent to me. I mean, I think, I hate to say it's back to cash pooling, I think it's a unit of account question. So you're supposed to come to a decision before you get to having a liability and asset to offset. And I just would like to see that explored more thoroughly.
Okay, Dwight, let's take it on.
Okay, I'll just start further analysis when in situations that they're not related. So looking at those situations, we think that the operator should first assess which party has the obligation to make the payment, and that will depend on facts and circumstances, very much dependent on the facts and circumstances of the arrangement. If the operator determines that it is obliged to make the payment to the lessor, then it has to assess when the liability should be recognized at the start of the arrangement or over the term of the arrangement. And on the basis of our analysis, we think that the operator should generally recognize this obligation at the start of the arrangement. And with respect, in this scenario, with respect to the presentation issue and whether or not you can present these assets and liabilities net, we think that they can only be offset if you meet the criteria for offsetting in IS 32.
I apologize. Can you kind of reset back to the beginning? Your mic was cut off.
Oh, I apologize.
And so the people listening in will get the point.
Okay. So just for scenarios in which the lessor is not related to the grantor, we think that the first assessment that the operator has to make is to analyze which party, whether the operator itself or the grantor, is obliged to make these lease-related payments. This would depend on the facts and circumstances and the terms of the overall arrangement between the three parties. If the operator determines that it is obliged to make these payments, it should then assess when it has to recognize the liability to make these payments. So would that be at the start of the arrangement or over the term of the arrangement? And on the basis of our analysis, we think that this would generally be at the start of the arrangement. And with respect to whether or not the operator can offset these assets and liabilities, we think that offsetting is only possible if they meet the criteria for offsetting in IS 32. So that was our analysis on the situations where they're not related. And I think we can progress the discussion on
that. Earl?
Just to reinforce my previous point, again, my concern is your conclusion was based on IFRS 16 and its rationale. I don't think if IFRIC 12 or other past standards was clear about this, and I'm comfortable with the reference, the inclusion of reference of IFRS 16 in the agenda as a base to this rationale, and nothing more different than this. I think it's a really important thing to improve in the agenda decision.
Does it trouble us that we're referring and trying to incorporate a standard that isn't effective yet?
I think maybe I would go beyond that, Nick Java, correct me if I'm wrong, is that clearly I'd be delighted to refer to IFRS 16 at every opportunity. but it just seems to me, and the reason why we hadn't done so is that the question obviously is asked about the accounting of the operator, and almost I think by definition, if we say this is part of a service concession arrangement, then we're saying the operator is not the lessee. It doesn't obtain the right to control the use of the infrastructure.
The rationale to address the liability was IFRS 16.
Well, I suppose it wasn't directly. Directly using the IFRS 16 requirements in a sense. What we were doing was picking up, trying to make reference to the board's most recent thinking. In a similar situation around when you might have assets and liabilities. But we felt it was beyond what it might be confusing if we were to refer to IFRS 16 in the agenda decision because it's about the operator's accounting, and by definition, he's not the lessee.
I see, but the current literature, effective literature, is not clear at all about this.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
All right, let's work our way around the room. I guess, Martin, did you want to come in?
I have a similar view with regard to IFRS 16. I mean, the original submission also includes IFRS 17. So the question is whether we want to be strict in terms of, well, considering this submission, we probably also have to spend some words on IFRS 17 or why there is no difference at all. If I go through paragraph 29, we say, those facts indicate that the operator is obliged to make the lease-related payments to the lessor. We do not think that the guarantee provided by the grantor to the lessor is operator's obligation to make lease-related payments as a financial liability. Okay, might be okay for IFRS 16 reasons. For IFRS 17 reasons, it might have an implication. At least we have to consider that. And then in paragraph 43, the topic of principal agent is discussed. However, in the final outcome, in the proposed wording, I miss a little bit the idea, or at least the hint, that this is facts and circumstances related or so. We could consider it to include it somewhere, probably on the second page of the agenda decision, between EE, for arrangements in which the lessor is not related to the grantor, the operator first assesses, and so on, and then we probably could add some wording on principal versus agent. Or probably there's a reason why you have not included it. I don't know.
Yes, to that point, the only reason we did not include it in the agenda decision because the submission was very much focused on whether or not there are assets and liabilities and whether you can offset those assets and liabilities. And because when we did our analysis, we said the only time you can offset them is when you meet the criteria in IAS 32, and the principal agent assessment was not relevant to the presentation on the balance sheet in this scenario. So, and because it was not asked in the question, we did not include it in the agenda decision.
Okay. Andrew?
I think we need to circle back on these overarching questions about, you know, what is the unit of account and which party in substance has the liability, given that, you know, we've got three parties or potentially two parties involved in the arrangements, but the payable receivable are negotiated at the same time in contemplation of one another as part of a single commercial arrangement, all of those factors. In this fact pattern, as I understand it, the operator has basically an unconditional obligation to pay the leasing company. Its right to cash from the grantor is actually not unconditional. The operator is exposed to technical and operational risk. So on that basis, although I don't think the paper really addresses the principal agent or conduit argument, I wouldn't run with the fact. I couldn't see it as a pure pass-through arrangement because the risks aren't mirroring, the risks don't match. So on that basis, I see how you get to a financial liability. You then seem to me to jump a step slightly, because you say that we're in the financial asset model, therefore the debit, we don't want to take that to P&L, so let's take the debit to financial asset. The way I read IFRIC 12, the financial asset model is purely in the context of consideration for construction or upgrade services. So if we are going to recognize a financial asset as opposed to some other type of asset, then we also have to be satisfied that we have a financial asset in terms of IFRS 9. Certainly if we, in the related party variation of the fact pattern, we kind of looked to IFRS 15 for guidance. If we looked at IFRS 15 for guidance on this issue, what type of asset do we have? I think we'd say it's more of a contract asset on the grounds that it's not yet unconditional due to the exposure to operating and technical risk. So I think there's just some more analysis there.
Jennifer, can I Just to understand, I think, and Java, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there are actually almost two separate pieces to the rights that the operator has from the grantor, which might be confusing. So one is that he does have an unconditional right to receive cash in relation to any payments he makes to the lessor. And it was that piece that we were saying the operator would recognize as the financial asset. Separately, he also has a right, and the other separately could be, you know, one of the two routes. It could be that he has a right to receive, you know, money from the grantor. Alternatively, it could be he has a right to, you know, recoup money from sort of operation of the, you know, the infrastructure. So there was kind of two separate rights going on. I think it's possibly not a bit confusing, not clear.
Can you clarify the fact pattern with the submitted? Because I'm reading the fact pattern that it just says the TOC will not be reimbursed if it's responsible for an interruption of service, and that follows on from a description of the service that includes reference to the lease-related services. So maybe you have clarified the fact pattern. So if you haven't, I think the fact pattern is at least ambiguous.
No, I'm just trying to find it, but it does say in the fact pattern that the operator will have generally has an unconditional right to receive cash in respect of the lease payments that it is required to make, and I'm just trying to find that.
If that is the case, I want to look again at the conduit argument, and this is basically a pass-through arrangement.
Yeah. But it does, actually.
Absolutely, offsetting risks.
Yeah, and just so you know, it's probably not fleshed out as much as it could be, but I think that was the starting point in our analysis, was the first, you know, even when we say the grantor and the lessor are not related, the first question is to assess who do you think really, you know, is obliged to make these payments to the lessor. And I think that could, you know, that would depend on looking quite closely at whether, you know, you think the operator is literally just, you know, the cash is just sort of flowing in and flowing out. But he doesn't, you know. And for example, if something, you know, if something happened one way, you know what I mean, that he would have no risk exposure. And so that would be the first question. To the extent you say, even though on paper he's going to pay the cash over to the lessor, if he really is not obliged to it, ultimately the grantor is, then.
So my final question then is just a question. If you started by saying, is there a financial asset, and said yes. If you started by saying, oh, is there a financial liability? Well, if you start with a financial asset, have you tested whether, if this is a pure pass-through, whether that meets the due recognition criteria for financial assets?
Sorry, I don't.
Well, you said there's a, in effect, I think the paper argues there's a financial asset because there's a financial liability, and we're in the financial asset model, which I've challenged as a line of argument.
Yeah.
If we have an unconditional right to cash, we have a financial asset, and if that meets the pass-through tests in IS 39, IFRS 9, we do recognise the financial asset. Mm-hmm.
So to that question, in effect, we think if the operator has an obligation, if the operator is required to recognize the obligation for the lease-related services at the start of the arrangement, it effectively means it has provided the lease-related services. Whether or not it recognizes in the income statement will depend on the principal agent assessment and the facts of the case. But if it's recognized the obligation, it's effectively recognized its cost of providing the lease-related services. And because it has an unconditional right to receive cash for providing those services, it has also got the right at the same time for providing the services, and it can recognize the asset correspondingly at the same time.
But I think maybe, is your point, Andrea, is thinking about if it is a pass-through for the operator, then you wouldn't really have the financial assets.
I'm only asking, has the analysis been done? So if the operator only has to pay the leasing company if it gets paid by the grantor, I think there's at least a question as to whether that is a pass-through, not in substance, or in substance as well, but under literature.
Yeah, I think
that would be the scenario where we'd say,
correct,
if I'm right, that where we'd say we don't think the operator in that scenario would actually have really be obliged to make the payments to the lessor, it would actually be the grantor. So we'd be in that bucket that said, yeah, we don't think in that scenario then that he does have the financial asset and financial liability.
Okay. Carl?
A doubt. In my recollection, the scope exclusion of leases and concessions was included in IFRIC 4, and IFRIC 4 was replaced, right? That exclusion was imported to IFRS 16 explicitly. Okay.
I've lost track of sequence, so I'm just going with geography. John?
I mean, I'm generally in agreement with the staff view here. I think that the right of use is with the grantor, not with the operator, because you're in service concession. And therefore, the operator doesn't have a lease liability. They have a liability owed to somebody called a lessor, but it's not a lease liability. I think the answer is the same whether you're in IAS 17 or IFRS 16. I don't think there's any difference. So I think what they have is some form of financial liability arising from a contract. And I think they have a financial asset being the right to cash from the grantor. And I think you need to apply IAS 39 to determine whether you can either offset those or de-recognize them, as Andrew said. So I would agree with the staff analysis.
Okay, I'm going to go with Bob and Tony, and I'm going to make sure I don't forget Sandy and Paylon. Bob?
Okay. I hear John, but I guess I'm struggling with the staff's analysis, because I would agree that the grantor has the right to use asset, and then the grantor would have, in my mind, then the lease obligation. And then if we're saying that the operator also has an obligation to the lessor, now I've got the lessor sitting with two receivables. And I know they only have one.
You see, I think in the scenario where if we say that we think the operator is obliged to pay the lessor, I think the payable that the grant, if we're assuming, you know, they're doing their books, the liability that the grantor has is therefore to the operator. They owe cash to the operator, and the operator has a financial asset or receivable from the grantor. But
okay.
But I think if I understand, you're probably saying that you don't, you know, that maybe you view the whole transaction as just being a service concession in a sense between.
Yeah, it was going there, and then that kind of also led, because I heard then we were saying that the obligation that the operator has is based on facts and circumstances. What facts and circumstances? How do I do this analysis of whether their obligation is to the lessor or to the grantor?
So I think, could jump in whenever, but I think if I was looking at the arrangement, for example, and if I saw a term where the operator has to make payments to the lessor, regardless of whether or not it is reimbursed by the grantor, if those were the facts, for example, that might indicate that the operator has an obligation, has a direct obligation to the lessor, and then the facts are not such that it's the lessor who has the obligation. So it could be some variations of fact patterns like that, but it would very much depend on the terms and conditions. But that's the one example that I was thinking of as I was envisioning the first step of analyzing who has the obligation.
And maybe just to counter on the other side of that, yeah. I might pick up Andrew's example. If, in contrast, it was that the operator's not obliged at all to sort of make payments to the lessor unless, you know, the grantor pays him, and ultimately the lessor gets all its guarantees from the grantor, then you might say in that scenario it just looks like a pass-through. So I don't think the operator has the obligation, and he would neither have the financial asset nor the financial liability.
Tony?
Yeah, my view is very similar to John's. I guess I'd rather we didn't get hung up here on IFRS 16, IAS 17, because the lease is to the grantor in this case. So I think we need to look to other standards. And I think what we talked about last time was we don't need to analogize when we have standards that are on point. And I think it's the financial asset, financial liability standards that are actually on point. And so that's where we should do the analysis. If the construct is, yes, the grantor has a right of use, but it's going to allow the operator to use those assets to operate the service concession, then yes, the lease is with the grantor, because the grantor controls the right of use. But if it's set up in a way that the operator is sitting there with the obligation to pay the owner of the assets, the legal owner of the assets, and that obligation exists even if the grantor was to go bust, then it does seem to me there ought to be an asset and a liability there. I agree with Andrew, we would apply IAS 39 to test that, but that feels to me like it's the right answer. I still wonder about where we get to in the previous example, but I still think that feels like the right answer. And I would share Martin's comment that we talk about principal agent in the paper, and then it doesn't appear in the final agenda decision. And so it's, what do we mean when we talk about principal agent? What are the factors that we're taking into account? And having talked about it in the paper, I find it curious that the final agenda decision is then silent.
Okay, let's go to the phone. Sandy?
I don't have anything to add.
Okay. Hey, Long?
I agree with the self-analysis on the treatment when lesser is not related to the grantor. But some concerns on the treatment when lesser is related to the grantor. First, grantor and lesser are still different legal entities. Unless the two parties have other contractual agreement to substantial that the lesson is on behalf of the grantor. Furthermore, even staff will is supportable in this regard. It seems more appropriate to be treated separately from revenue deduction, as it is a separable element for payments to customer, which will be eventually reimbursed. And about the agenda decision, guidance on what falls within the definition of infrastructure in which this decision is applicable will be helpful. For example, a public bus operator leasing buses from a non-public private company over short-term leases. Under the decision above, should the operating lease for buses being recognized on a statement of financial position?
Katrina,
that'd be helpful.
I suppose I think if I caught some of the conversation, I might link it back to something that Martin said, which is I think that any kind of conversation or analysis here around actually lease accounting, we kind of think is not, you know, so we don't need to go into IAS 17 versus IFRS 16 or talk about short-term leases or anything else directly in lease accounting, because we're talking about the accounting from the operator's perspective. And as I said again, you know, once we say it's a service concession, then by definition it's not a lease for the operator. So I'd suggest we don't sort of go into directly into lease accounting land.
Charlotte, last call.
I just want to come back to say something that Petrina said, and I suppose it's that question of the path through arrangement and how you could regard that. I think I've seen in other places where a path through arrangement is really could be seen as a sort of subset of a principal agency relationship, and it's sort of the time when in an agency relationship you actually don't recognize the asset. And I suppose the question is, when does an agency relationship become that compared to when is it just an agency relationship where you recognize the asset? Because I've also seen in the past people saying that you never don't recognize the financial asset and liability in an agency relationship. But in the staff paper, it implies that you always recognize the financial asset a liability in an agency relationship, even if you have no credit risk whatsoever and it was a pure flow through. And I'd just like to see that explored in more detail.
I think, again, that comes back to the first step in the assessment, where the operator has to analyze who has the which party has the obligation to make the payment. And if it is truly a flow through and there is no obligation,
but
for example, unless I get reimbursed, there is no obligation. It depends on the terms and conditions, but if there is no obligation, then we would say that there is no asset and liability.
I think you're sort of putting it in the wrong order. I suppose the question for me is, what does that mean about who is the principal, who is the agent, what are the facts and circumstances, and then where do you go from there? At the moment, the sort of principal-agent question is just sort of left there hanging, and it says you still recognise the financial asset and liability and you can't offset. rather than saying actually because the relationship is such that you might not have one in the first place.
Okay. When I got this one, I had to draw a picture to understand, as the old U.S. comedy skit goes, who's on first. I don't think my picture works anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to let Petrina try and tell us where we are.
Well, I'm going to try and summarize what I heard, and maybe, and then people can tell me whether I've got it right or wrong. I am hearing most people, I'm hearing some concern and question about recognizing the asset and liability, but I think with the extra kind of focus or clarification around, you know, who really has the obligation, is it just a pass-through, or is it, you know, that the operator really has the obligation to pay the lessor and therefore has a right from the grantor. In scenarios when the grantor and the lessor are unrelated, I'm hearing most people reasonably comfortable with, I think, what the staff analysis and the agenda's decision is saying there. Where there's a bit more uncertainty, there's been a couple of comments about the reference to principal agent in the paper and whether that should flow through to the agenda decision. So I think that's something to think about. And the other piece where I think I've heard some questions that I suppose makes me pause as well is maybe a question says, do the committee members agree or think, or maybe they don't, do they see any difference in how the accounting should work depending on whether the grantor and lessor are under common control related parties or are not? And I suppose some of the first conversation, even perhaps from Bob and John and Tony, at least indicated that maybe some people are saying maybe they shouldn't, the accounting shouldn't be different just on the basis that they're related or common control.
So everything would flow to the second set of recommendations.
So everything would flow to the second set of recommendations. I'm not sure though then if that's where all the committee members feel comfortable with.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I think the analysis is the same. But I think, I mean, it seems to me that you're sort of dealing with financial assets and financial liabilities arising from the contract. So you've got to apply the requirements in 39. If you believe that really that cash flows are, don't have substance because it's sort of coming from there and going to there, and you then say, you know, it's really just, you consider it together. But I think you have to go through, to me, you have to go through IAS 39 to get there. And similarly, any type of derecognition analysis would have to apply the requirements of IAS 39. I don't know, the fact that there's a principal agent would mean I don't have a financial asset and a financial liability. Lots of agents might be acting as an agent, but they've got a financial asset and a financial liability, even if they're not accepting any credit risk in between either. So I my view is you have to apply IAS 39, and that takes you where it takes you.
So I suppose, I might ask whether then, and I suppose we do that by asking, you know, the question, but I don't know whether the committee members feel that based on this discussion they are ready to vote on the agenda decision subject to,
or do they feel... The agenda decision would have to be significantly reworked.
Yes, that's absolutely right, based on that.
The issue for us, as it often is it so significant a rework that we have to bring it back?
Maybe.
Or are you comfortable with us reworking it and you seeing it when you see output? It seems to me, and I have a wealth of ignorance on this one, that we need to bring it back.
I agree. I mean, I think from our perspective, we're happy to do that.
Okay. Tony, do you have an objection to bringing it back?
No, I was simply going to say I am not sure yet the analysis in the related party under common control situation is complete, given the comments that the committee has put to the staff.
Yeah.
And I think we probably do need to ask the committee.
I think we need to tease out whether there is a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little bit more, because I think those comments at the start of the discussion were very helpful.
Yeah.
Bob?
If we're going to bring it back, I just add one more comment that I think needs to be addressed, and that is, as I look at the agenda decision, as I go through within the scope section, item A, assessing whether it's in the scope of IFRIC 12 requires careful consideration. I agree with that. In order to be within IFRIC 12, I understand, paragraph 5, the grantor has to control the residual interest. Correct. We describe in paragraph 2 some facts where I'm not sure, in that case, the grantor controls the residual interest. They've got a residual value guarantee, but in my mind, residual value guarantee doesn't grant control of the residual interest. Now, if they had a renewal option, a purchase option, and I think we just need to marry up with the facts so that somebody could understand where you might have a situation within 12.
Valid point.
Thank you. That's good. Helpful.
I'm going to go to Andrew and then Carl.
Yeah, I support bringing it back, and not just because I won't be around to discuss it. but, yeah, I think on the, does it make a difference if they're related parties? We need to address the question whether in substance the fact that they're related parties means that this is a payment to a customer. So is the related party part of the same customer relationship that we have with the grantor in effect? And then on the non-related party situation, if we have a financial liability, I would like to see some analysis of whether it really is a financial asset, because I am struggling to read the fact pattern, which you might have clarified directly to the submitter, to say that there is an unconditional right to cash.
Yep. Yeah.
Carl, last call.
Yeah, similar. I would like to see arguments for the financial liability other than the IFRIC 16, IFRS 16.
Okay.
Thank you.
You did so well on the other one, and then this one. I don't know what to make of it.
No,
he's coming back later, so.
Yeah. Or, oh, you get 3 tries. Yeah. Okay.
I get 4.
Okay.